Coming to you by way of the not-for-profit Mainframe Studios at 900 Keough Way in downtown Des Moines, welcome to 900 Views, where we explore building community through the arts as we build an arts community. I'm your host, Pat Bodie. Today's guest is Benjamin Gardner. He has chaired the Department of Art and Design at Drake University. He serves as associate art professor there and apparently has unfailingly kept up his own studio work, including a relatively recent series dubbed Made with Color on his website, benjamingardner.com. That's Gardner with one E. He's also a gifted baker. We're going to try and talk about that. So we'll be doing this culinary discussion. I first met Benjamin when he and my son, Andy Davis, were inaugural visual artists for Emily and Mason Kessinger's Yellow Door Gallery in Des Moines, a gallery that has re-envisioned the concept of salon and will be a topic of an upcoming 900 Views episode. You can find them on Facebook. Meanwhile, Benjamin's artist statement includes this provocative sentence: questions about the cosmological existence of the human race, why we produce culture, and the state of after existence are important ones to my reading and studio practice. So let's parse this a little bit, and you just got to start with cosmological existence of the human race. What does that even really mean?
Well, I think it's a way of, kind of a funny way for me to talk about that my work is being about everything. You know what I mean? Like I really enjoy investigating and researching and learning about lots of different subjects. And so I think when I start to write an artist statement, it seems like a little reductive for me to focus on any of one of those things in particular. So I think I talk about cosmological existence, and that, like, I think it kind of allows me to put almost anything that I want to into my artwork. But I think that it has to do with, like philosophy would say that it's ontology, in that it's sort of like the thinking and discussing of being, like what it means to be, exist.
Well, let's touch on that a little bit, because you talk about the state of after existence. Mm-hmm. Is an important state for you and your work. And one of the pieces that I really wanted to touch base with you on was one that just really caught my eye, partly because I've been preparing for a visit to the Guggenheim to see that Helma F. Klint exhibit.
Oh, yes.
Where she had done a lot of work where she felt as though she was the medium for some higher power. And that was how she produced some of her work. And you have this piece called Temple of 1,000 Doors. So how do you work with this concept of art and spirituality?
I think that it's actually come a lot from both my personal life, in terms of, like, you know, I'm probably agnostic / Buddhist, I don't know what I would classify myself as now, but I grew up in a church, and so I still have that sort of moral backing. But then also, the artworks that I've been interested in my life, and it's not even really art. I mean, Helma F. Klint is an example of an individual artist, but then I also responded when I was in school to Shaker gift drawings, mm-hmm. which are the same sort of idea. You know, the Shakers made these beautiful drawings that they thought were communications from God. And so it was almost like a visual prayer in some ways. So I've just had this background and attraction, I think, to, like, artists that have worked with ideas of spirituality in all sorts of different forms.
How do you see people responding to pieces like that?
It's a really interesting question. I think, you know, it's something that affects all of us to a certain extent, even if it's through, you know, atheism or agnosticism. You know what I mean? I think everybody sort of has some sort of cultural link to spirituality in some ways. So I would imagine, I don't know this for sure, but I would speculate, I guess, that most people approach it through their own sort of spiritual lens in the background that they bring to it. You know, if I use a word like temple in a title, that means a bunch of different things to a bunch of different people. in a good way, I think. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think that it's only restricted to sort of houses of worship of any particular faith or spirituality background, spiritual background.
Well, now, the other phrase here is why we produce culture. And of course, since we always try and talk a little bit about here about the community,
yeah,
and the role of arts and culture in community and community in supporting arts and culture, where do those intersect? Why we produce culture and build community?
That's another great question. I think that it's one of the sort of most basic relationships that I can have with a person, even when I first meet them, or if, like, say it's somebody that has, like, you know, my daughter goes to Grace Preschool, and it's somebody who also has a son or a daughter at Grace.
And that's Grace Methodist Church.
Yeah, yes, exactly. Sorry. It's a way for me to start to get to know that person or sort of link to somebody, and not in like a judgmental way, you know, if they like The Bachelor or something, like, I'm not gonna judge them based on that, but it is like, you know, we can always talk about movies or television or books, and I find that those sort of relationships build into really positive directions and help form community.
How well is the arts community supported here by the community, in your view?
So this is my 10th year in Des Moines, and I, coming from a smaller community with a big state college in it, I think that it's more supported here in some ways than the place that I used to live.
Which was Virginia, or?
No, it was Bloomington, Illinois.
Oh, okay.
Normal, Illinois. And in part, like, Bloomington Normal is just like there's a big state college. Illinois State is there. So there's a community connected to the college, but then the community outside of the college is there but struggles a little bit, I think. And moving to Des Moines, I think that there was a stronger community from the start. But I also think that it's in an upward, it's going in an upward direction. Like, the community seems to be improving every year that I've lived here, which I think is more important in some ways. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like...
What do you mean by improving?
Well, I feel like there's more people that are becoming active in the community in various ways, and probably even showing me, and I don't know if this is true for others, but showing me different ways to be active in the community that aren't necessarily like just like I'm an artist and you have to listen to me talk about my work. You know, like there's other sort of forms of building community, I think, that people are doing a great job of developing in Des Moines.
What are you finding that's intriguing to you?
I feel like, I mean, Mainframe is definitely an example of this, I think. And I also feel like there's sort of, anytime you have like a big organization or an entity, I feel like let's say the Des Moines Arts Center or something like that, they do a lot of great work. And then there's people that are on the fringe of that, that are involved in stuff, but they also want to do good work. And so they work really hard at developing things. Like, I'm thinking about, there's other, you know, Mainframe started, and then there's also a few other sort of artists building studios that are going up now, which I think is good. And I don't think it's competition. I think it's actually expanding the community. Because it is, like, when I moved here, I was hoping to be able to find a studio space. And I was priced out, you know what I mean, the year that I... And I had my first full-time salaried job, so I thought for sure I'd be able to afford a studio space. But I've just had it in the apartment that I lived in, and then in the houses that I've lived in since.
Yes, so
then.
It's upstairs here above our
exactly.
dining room table attic. Conversation.
Yeah, it's in the attic. It's currently, I checked the temperature, it's 48 degrees in my studio.
That's why we're in the dining room, folks. We're at the tail end of the polar vortex here, so
exactly.
What can we do?
Exactly.
That must freeze. Do you freeze paint up there?
Not yet, not quite. Yeah, and I have like foot warmers and hand warmers to keep warm while I'm working. So,
so you like those things along the fringes. As an educator, you're kind of doing, and this may really just be an art mom's perception, right? But as an art mom, my son is an artist too, we envision that they will graduate, get a teaching job, and teach, and then do studio art kind of on the side.
Yeah.
Tell me how this is really balanced out for you. How realistic is that, and how fair is that?
The thing that's changed, so I taught at Illinois State University for a little while too before I came here. And there it was very much the fact that I had students that wanted to be visual artists. Like they wanted to graduate with that degree. Drake's a little bit different. Drake is sort of recruit students, I think, that have some ideas of what they want to do. But the vast majority of them don't want to be visual artists. So it makes my job a little bit easier in some ways because I don't have to like reassure them that, oh, you can make some money being a visual artist. What's most interesting to me since teaching at Drake is that my students that I work with have jobs that I never would have been able to tell them were available because the job market's changing so rapidly.
So like?
Like I had a student that came in and wanted to be a medical illustrator, like wanted to draw cadavers, I guess. And I was just like, that doesn't exist anymore. You know, I mean, I don't know what to tell you. Like, I can't reassure you that you're going to get a job in that. It does exist. I'm not trying to be a jerk. But and so she went through the program, and we worked together on different options. And she went to graduate school for museum studies, and now she's working for a company called Taylor Studios in Central Illinois that designs large-scale installations for, like, interpretive centers, for national and state parks. You know, I mean, like right now she, or just like a few weeks ago, her name's Grace Carroll. She was in Juneau, Alaska doing research for another project. Yeah, I mean, I would have never been able to tell her that that was like something she should pursue. And Taylor Studios got its start because they knew that there was a need for dinosaur eggs in natural history museums. So they started in a garage making facsimiles of dinosaur eggs.
We'll have to talk to them sometime,
I think now it's like a Fortune 500 company. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
it's a pretty amazing thing. So.
So what you're saying, if I'm hearing you correctly, is there are just so many pathways. There's no way of predicting what the best path is. This is one that's worked for you, but there's any number of possibilities, and they're becoming more endless.
Absolutely. And they change all the time too, you know. And even like the way that Andy handles things versus the way, you know what I mean, like
Andy's my son.
Yeah, sorry. The way that we approach being visual artists is different, but we're still sort of like at the same, we're still peers, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like it doesn't, I don't have to choose the things that Andy chooses to be a professional artist, and he doesn't have to choose the things that I do. But we're definitely peers in that sense that we're both visual artists based in Des Moines.
And you're finding over time that this community in the Midwest more broadly is increasing its ability to kind of support and sustain creatives like yourself?
Definitely. Yeah, definitely.
Is there any secret sauce that's missing?
I think Mainframe is gigantic, and there's going to be 200 studios, but I still would like to see more studio space available for people, because I feel like if there's a vacuum, it will get filled, especially when it comes to affordable studio space for artists. And like, just in one of the benefits of Mainframe is that like you have so many different people working together in the same building that it's a pretty amazing mix of things, you know, and that would happen and could happen in other parts of the city too.
Now, when you were talking about where you used to come from, I mentioned Virginia because that was where your dad was from, kind of the Appalachian piece, and that's a little bit about what's been some of the inspiration for your culinary work. Is that fair?
Definitely. Yeah, like my uncle used to say that our family crest had two crossed forks on it. Because we like to eat. It's like a pretty big part of that family, and my mom's side of the family too, but definitely in Appalachia.
So the first baked goods of yours I tried were turmeric, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, sugar cookies.
Correct, yeah.
Buckwheat chocolate kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Fabulous. Thanks. Absolutely. Yeah. And it really crossed this. It was sweet and yet savory all at the same time. I still don't know how you did it. I think you're onto something. Thanks. And now you're shifting over to this leavened bread, which I haven't gotten to taste yet, but I've gotten to see photos of.
Yeah.
It looks like it would be amazing. What caused the shift and how are we going to get to partake over time?
Yeah, I think the cookies definitely come from sort of at least partially nostalgia and having sort of like baked goods around the holidays. And there's something about that sort of winding down that starts in October for me. I just want to bake like sweeter, you know, baked goods, I think cookies. And so we've been sort of tweaking some of those recipes and having fun with that. And then I don't...
Why tweaking with the more savory type flavors?
Yeah, I don't... I'm very much, like, not a sweet, sweet person. Like, there's nothing that will turn me off. Like, probably about the only food that I won't eat is, I have to say, like, sweet food. Like, really sweet food. Like,
that's what was so amazing about these baked goods. So, folks, try your turmeric and your sugar cookies. And, unless he's doing it, then go get his. Yeah. So you switched over then to this bread piece.
Yeah, I started reading, and it seems like it's gone in waves, but I got a hold of a few books that were written in the 90s about sourdough production in California, and not necessarily the big companies that were making sourdough, but like individual people who are building bread ovens in their backyard and making sourdough. And there's also a couple in Vermont that I think I read a few years ago. They had to sell their space, but they just had a oven in a more or less a shack on top of a mountain in Vermont, and they would go in and they would make sourdough. You know, I mean, I think that there's sort of this lore and I don't know, maybe a little bit nostalgia to sourdough bread, but it's certainly becoming very popular on Instagram is what I'm telling a lot of people that are taking bread classes. There's a huge sourdough community on Instagram of people posting loaves and things like that.
Wow.
And now there's a sourdough podcast. So it's kind of gaining momentum and becoming really popular again now. But some of the books that I was reading talk about some of the health benefits of naturally leavened bread, which is pretty interesting, and I've got to a local source for a hard red spring wheat, so I should be able to make bread with, you know, flour that's 20 miles from Des Moines, natural yeast and water and salt, you know what I mean, which I think that there's something about the simplicity of those ingredients that I'm attracted to too, and such a variety of, you know, like I've had some loaves that are rock hard and we can hardly eat, so we have to like boil them into soup, and I've had some really great loaves too, you know.
You're not afraid to experiment, that's
not
for
at
sure.
All nope, not at all. Yeah,
so speaking of experimentation, you some of your more recent work is what you are referring to as uncanny landscapes. I was really drawn to those. One called the mushrooms, which is sort of a woodland setting with almost Alice in Wonderland,
yeah,
mushrooms
yeah.
in the foreground,
yeah.
And then the cabin, which reminds me of my backyard rain garden with the black-eyed Susans is the way I would interpret it. And we're going to be showing those photos on the Facebook page that accompanies this podcast. Plus, it's on BenjaminGardner.com. 2018, first two photos listed there. What has brought this kind of almost a conservation-themed piece in my mind's eye, a little bit biased probably from my background, to your work?
It's almost been like it's two separate interests of mine that I'd never really figured out how to visualize, and one of those would be food or even like food politics in some ways, or like how food is grown and where we get it from and things like that. So I think that that's maybe, that links to me in terms of conservation, because I have been trying for the last 5 to 6 years, I would say, seeing how close I can get food, you know what I mean? And
yes.
we still eat, like, my daughter eats bananas like crazy, you know what I mean? There's things that we still buy, we're not purists in that sense, but we've been really interested to see what we can grow ourselves and what we can find locally. Because there's a huge, I mean, we're in an agricultural land, right? So I think that there's a lot of access to food here. But I've always made paintings too, but I've never really figured out how to kind of put those together. But I picked up, we have a CSA from Grade A Gardens with Jordan Klassen, and he gave me these beautiful mushrooms one time at the CSA pickup, and I have to make a painting of that. I mean, they're beautiful form, you know, it's a beautiful form. And I have also been sort of interested lately in things like foraging for food and fermentation and things like that. So it's just sort of been a way that I've been able to sort of combine some of my interests in landscape paintings. I don't know why it never occurred to me before, but I think that's the way these things work. You know, you kind of have to let them naturally develop as opposed to force them together.
Well, and when you mentioned CSA, that's Community Supported Agriculture.
Yeah.
So in a way, we're really bringing it all back to this community building again.
Totally.
Are we not?
Yeah.
I really wish we had more time because I wanted to talk to you about the role of criticism in community and in education. And if you might just briefly touch on that, we'll delve deeper sometime in the future.
Yeah. So it's been like the backbone of my teaching, honestly. Like it's the thing that I go over the most with my students. And I think that it's a community with healthy criticism, I think, is always going to thrive. And so I think it may be part of the special sauce that we talked about. You know, like artists need space and they need discussion, like community discussion in the form of criticism, I think.
And I don't see a lot of that happening here yet,
am I mistaken? Yeah, no,
so
I think you're right.
How do we get that started? How would we get that ball rolling?
I don't know. It's been tough because I know some people have started some things. When I moved here, East Village Artist Coalition used to have critiques. And there's been a few other things. And I taught a Ray Society class with Siobhan and Susan Olson of Olson Larson and Aaron Tinder of Grandview about criticism. So I think
that's Grandview College, and Ray Society is kind of retirees enrollment at Drake. Fair enough?
Correct. Okay. Yep. Yeah. And it was beneficial. I think people understood it. But again, they're not artists necessarily. So I don't know. I don't know what's lacking necessarily, maybe other than we haven't found like an appropriate venue and mode of doing the criticism, maybe, so that people are wanting to continually and actively participate.
We'll have to explore that further in some upcoming items. I've been wondering about the role this podcast could play in that as well, so we'll talk about that sometime down the line. Before we go, I just want to mention a few places where you will be able to see Benjamin Gardner's work. March 18 to 21, he'll be the visiting artist at Middle Tennessee State University. He'll be making print editions with printmaking classes and lecturing. March 22nd, you can catch his work at the Sioux City Art Center Selects exhibition. Is that March 22nd and then beyond, or just March?
Correct. Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry to interrupt, but yeah, it opens on March, the evening of March 22nd, and then I think it's up for at least a month, if not longer.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And then join me, because if I'm in town, I'm going to be doing this. sign up for his April 26th bread baking class at the Des Moines Social Club. And as always, I'd like to remind you of First Friday Open Studios and Third Thursday 5 to 7 p.m. Happy Hours at Mainframe Studios, again at 900 KOA. I'm Pat Bode. Thanks for listening to 900 Views. Tell your friends, and let's keep enriching our community through the arts. Thank you.